is ready for a little bit of nostalgia on this lovely spring-like Sunday? If you're close to my age, you probably read some of the things that I read as a kid. I was a big Sweet Valley Twins and then Sweet Valley High reader. I also have to admit that I read Flowers in the Attic very early, and it freaking slayed me. I don't know where I got it. Did I find a copy in the attic or like under someone's bed? Or I don't know. I just know that I was reading this story of incest and child abuse very early. But that's not what we're talking about today. In fact, I do think the V.C. Andrews books should be a whole separate podcast. And Glynis and I have been working on that every time we have at least two glasses of wine. Today, we're talking about something much more family-friendly. We're talking about the Babysitter's Club. Yeah. There is this incredible podcast called Stuck in Stony Brook that goes back and revisits the Babysitter's Club books from a modern standpoint. And the individuals behind this podcast are so smart. They take a look at all of these books through an academic lens, a feminist lens, a political lens, an economic lens. The show is fun. It's freaking fun. And I essentially demanded that they let me come on as a guest as part of my I'm going to do 100 podcasts before The Sicilian Inheritance comes out. Seriously, I think I'm doing about 100 podcasts. But also, I just wanted to talk about the Babysitter's Club. That was a nice break for me. And in this episode, I get to talk about one of the mysteries. Yes, my friends. The mystery at the mall. You're going to be hooked on Stuck in Stony Brook. It's going to become one of your new faves. And I'm excited to share this episode where I got to be the guest.
Welcome to Stuck in Stony Brook, a podcast about the Babysitter's Club. Today, we're discussing Mystery 14, Stacy and the Mystery at the Mall. We also have a very special guest joining us today, Joe Piazza. Joe is the national and international bestselling author of We Are Not Like Them, You Were Always Mine, Charlotte Walsh Likes to Win, The Knockoff, and How to Be Married. Her work has been published in 10 languages in 12 countries, and four of her books have been optioned for film and television. Joe's podcasts, of which there are many, have garnered more than 25 million downloads and regularly top podcast charts. An editor, columnist, and travel writer, her work has also appeared in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, New York Magazine, Marie Claire, Glamour, and many other publications. She lives in Philly with her husband, Nick Astor, and three feral children. And on April 2nd, her brand new book, A Little Mystery of Her Own, The Sicilian Inheritance, will drop. So we're so thrilled to have you here with us to discuss the BSC. Welcome, Joe.
Okay.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me. You guys, this was such a gateway drug. Now that I revisited one of the mysteries, I need to read all of the mysteries.
Yeah.
Some of them are better than others. Yes. I will warn you in advance. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, we're just so excited to hear all of the things that you have to say and hear about your mystery as well, which I'm guessing is a little bit better than this one. No shade to Stacy and the Mystery at the Mall.
Shade to the Mystery at the Mall. None.
Yeah. Yeah. Where we play a game like, was it really a mystery? Is it a mystery? Yeah. So we'll have to play that with you at some point during this episode.
Yes. Because I have thoughts.
Excellent.
I don't want to spoil anything just yet.
So much to spoil in this mystery. Actually, there kind of is, huh?
Yeah.
More mystery in this mystery than other mysteries, I feel.
Yeah, but I don't know. Like from the very beginning of this, I was like, oh, don't make it be this. Don't make it. Oh, that's what it is. I knew it.
It's tough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not me. I didn't know till the very end. I'm kidding.
Edge of your seat the whole time.
Exactly. Okay. So let's get into our one sentence summaries of the book. I'll go first. The BSC members get fake jobs at the mall, then create more unpaid work for themselves.
Classic. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They'd work on vacation and they work at work. Yeah.
Mine is similar. I went with the girls get the equivalent of unpaid internships at the mall, and Stacy appropriately gets sad calling CPS.
Yeah. Okay. You got to take it dark already, Emily. Mine was Stacy and the gang learn about the importance of balancing serving your community with capitalism and ending retail shrink.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Mine is also very similar. The BSC take on even more unpaid labor while navigating child protective services.
All right. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, we took similar things from this.
We really did. Yeah.
All right.
I feel like maybe that means it's a good book.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, the worst books were like, there was a red shirt on the playground. That's my summary.
Tells kids not to smoke.
But very consistent this time. So.
Yeah, very consistent. Yeah, well, I mean, there were some very consistent themes in this.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, those summaries could also be applied to probably half of the Babysitter's Club books too, right?
True, but you know
unpaid
what?
Labor. Yeah.
These girls love to work and they just don't care about getting paid for it.
It's
they
true.
Sure do. Yeah.
It's true.
Sure do.
I love it.
Okay. We should probably back up and tell you about the members of the podcast. I'm Annie Chikala, a freelance writer. I'm a mischievous pragmatist with a sweet tooth.
I'm Emily Crandall, a feminist scholar. I'm a total individual and I like health food. Nope, never.
I'm Esme Schaller, an adolescent psychologist. I'm kind of bossy, but I have a big heart.
I'm Joe Piazza, a journalist and a best-selling novelist. And I am definitely still a Christie in my adult life.
Fabulous. We love the consistent queen. Yes. Yeah. If you want to learn more about us and how we know each other, you can check out our prologue episode. Also, please rate and review us. It really helps people find the podcast. If you have any questions, comments, or commentary about anything BSC related, you can drop us a line at stuckinstonybrook@gmail.com. You can also support us on Patreon at patreon.com/stuckinstonybrook.
Oh, it's in there. Yay. Okay. Well, welcome, Joe. Before we get into the book, we want our listeners to be able to get to know you a little bit. Yeah. So we got to start off with the obvious. Tell us when you first started reading the BSC books and what made you fall in love with them.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, I think I was reading the BSC books from the beginning of my middle grade reading journey. It was the Judy Blume of WA and BSC. Those were the first chapter books that I read. Mm-hmm. So I feel like that's probably around the beginning of BSC. I'd meant to look this up. When did they first publish? What year?
86.
Okay, that's fair. Yeah, because I think I started reading books like this when I was around 7, 8. Mm-hmm. And so I've had them from the very beginning. And I have such a visceral, almost Pavlovian reaction to seeing the old cover. You guys mailed me a copy of The Mystery at the Mall. And I can immediately smell a mall bookstore, right?
Yeah,
like I can smell Walden Books in the mall when I see these covers, and I just remember sitting on the floor, you know, with the wall-to-wall carpeting because that was a thing in the 80s, and pulling the books off the shelf. And I would get them as they came out. This was happening in real time to me.
Oh friends, yeah,
because I am from the Stone Age, and so it was a big deal when the books came out. I felt like these girls were my friends.
Yeah,
I really did. And they were older than me, right? So they were aspirational in a way, and not so much older, but in the beginning, definitely significant amount. This is how I wanted to be in the world was like the girls in the Babysitter's Club.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wonder if that's the reason why they stay in eighth grade forever. You like age up to them and then they're sort of like a nostalgia,
and then you launch
you
go into your your older,
and then you start reading Sweet Valley High and it all goes off the rails.
Exactly.
Okay, so you've already mentioned that you are and you were and still are a Christie. Is Christie the character that you've always most resonated with? Are there other of the girls that you sort of aspire to be or kind of resonate with, even if you don't identify with them?
You know, I think I definitely resonated with all of them at some point, right? And that was kind of the genius of these books. And in their very particular 80s way, like each of the girls had something that you could fall a little bit in love with and relate to. Mm-hmm. And as I was growing up, I wanted to be Stacy because she seemed like the coolest one. Yeah. She was from, I mean, I grew up in the suburbs of Philadelphia, which is a less rich version of the suburbs of Connecticut. I did not understand the economics of the Babysitter's Club until I was reading it as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, on this reread, I will say they talk about class a lot more than you expect.
Yeah.
It's like it's in your face a lot more than I see it in children's literature now, which I think mm-hmm. is really interesting. But so, yeah, I grew up in the suburbs. I grew up going to the mall and doing mm-hmm. a lot of things they did. And I always felt like a Christie because, you know, I'm like, I'm a worker. I'm going to get things done. Mm-hmm. I am a very stereotypical Virgo, which is how I would describe Christie. I'd love to be a Stacy, but I'm not that cool. I'd love to be as laid back as Dawn, but I'm definitely not as shy as Marianne. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it was very Christie all the way for me. Although mm-hmm. I think there's one detail that Claudia's room was painted in, you could correct me, it was a very specific color scheme. It was like purple and red, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that to my room. Whatever Claudia's amazing. Color scheme was, I painted my room in those colors. I think it was purple, red, and black.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
I love that. I love that. Well, and I love that you had the self-knowledge as a kid that you were, because I'm definitely a Christie, but I think I was like in denial about it as a younger kid. And I definitely identified more with Marianne. And then it took me a while to grow into my Christiness.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in the beginning, too, you're just like, oh, Marianne is the only one with a boyfriend. And that seems important.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely. My biggest sort of journey on the podcast and our revisit is I always, always very identified with Dawn, and she kind of sucks as an adult. She's like sort of a brat, and like, I don't know, she she decides that something is happening and then sort of blows everything up. And I'm like, damn.
Yeah.
Ooh, I will tell you, it was kind of, I didn't like Dawn that much. And also California seemed so crazy far away, like a different mm-hmm. country. So I was relieved. Dawn is not in Mystery at the Mall. And that was kind of nice.
Yeah, she's in California for 6 months. Yeah. So you
oh, you're
have
right.
To, yeah. She's you're in a season where she's not living there. Yeah.
But interestingly, so, you know, I remember very vividly when Mallory and Jesse joined the crew. I hadn't thought about Shannon in a long time. I had forgotten about private school Shannon joining the crew.
Again, more class.
More
right?
class. No, that's the thing. I mean, they talk about how Christie's stepdad is so rich, right?
Every book. Constantly.
Every book.
It's a mansion. It's not a big house.
It's a mansion. And Shannon goes to private school, and that is fancy, and she has a bus ride away.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, they talk about it a lot, and they also do a lot of differentiating between like old money and new money and like the right kind of rich person versus like tacky kind of rich people and who cares
or
about
snobby
the community.
And mean rich people. Yeah.
Yes. And also so much divorce.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean classic 80s, right? Everyone I knew had divorced parents in the 80s.
Yeah.
Oh,
needed to rep it for sure. Yeah.
So do you think the books had any impact on your future or your current, but as a kid, on your future career as a journalist or writer or even podcasting?
Well, you know, I have to say that the mystery series, I loved the mystery books, and I love them because I've just always been curious. And I think that's what led me to become a journalist. And like, I just want to figure things out. I just want to you know, go in and report and figure out the world. And so, yeah, I do think that those series, like that series, the mystery one in particular, you know, kind of cultivated a love of discovery and my general curiosity. But more than anything, I was actually just with some old friends this weekend who have known me since college. And I was bitching and moaning about the world of book publishing. I'm like, it's falling apart. I'm going to have to find a new job. And they're like, you are a world-class hustler, Piazza. You will figure it out. Okay. If AI starts writing the books, you are going to be managing the AI machine. And I was like, I think it all comes back to like this like entrepreneurial spirit that was taught to me in the Babysitter's Club.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no, like you've got this. You're just gonna build a business. You may get paid nothing, girls. Yeah. But I do think that it engendered that entrepreneurial hustle spirit, which I think Christie has the most of.
Yeah, for sure.
There's always kids who need watching, even on vacation.
Yeah.
Even in Seattle City, New Jersey.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I love that you said that, Joe, because I was thinking, you know, I of the three of us, I'm the most familiar with your work. And I was sort of describing you to Anne and Emily and all the different things that you've done. And you've had all these different stages in your career, exactly as you're talking about, in terms of doing political reporting, celebrity gossip, travel writing, very different, you know, novels and nonfiction books, like all, you know, and now covering influencer culture and doing the things that you're doing with Under the Influence and with your Substack. And I feel like you actually, your expertise overlaps with all three of us. Like Anne is a freelance writer and was in teen mags and also is like definitely the biggest hustler out of us. But we call her the lazy hustler because she doesn't like to work as much as you do, but she does hustle. You know, and then I know a lot about parenting and some of the other things that you're reporting on now. And you do a ton of stuff about feminism and political things. And that all overlaps with Emily. And I'm just curious, like if there's, you already mentioned that you're naturally curious, like that's very evident. If there's like things that you have loved the most about these different stages, or if you just like the change and like, you know, the additional curiosity and kind of moving along.
I like the change. I like, you know, following different threads and covering different topics. You know who hates it? My agents. They're like, could you just do one
pick a
thing?
Lane. Yeah.
Like, you must be hard to describe.
Yeah.
I'm hard to describe. You know who has a lane? Colleen Hoover. And she sells a lot of books. And
yeah.
And they're like, I even selling The Sicilian Inheritance recently because I hadn't written a mystery or thriller before, and it is also historical fiction adjacent. There were entire publishing houses, despite the fact that I have sold a lot of books before, that were like, we don't know how to market that. And I'm like, you market it as a book is what you do.
You're like, to be read by people.
To be read by humans. Yeah. So like, but this isn't what Joe does. And I'm like, well, I did it. So it is what I do. And it's just amazing. I mean, the publishing world is broken and sad. But I would say I have a through line in all of my work. And I think that, you know, my jam, my lane is trying to tell stories about women that have not been told before, particularly women and ambition and women and agency. And even one of my nonfiction books, If Nuns Ruled the World, seems like such an outlier, but it's a story about women that has not been told. And it's a story about ambitious women that has not been told. Sadly, there is not a section in the bookstore for stories about ambitious women. But when I open my bookstore, which I'm going to call Nice Things, because you deserve nice things, and it will also sell, it will also sell wine and cheese so that it makes money.
Okay.
I will have a section that is called Books About Ambitious Women.
Yeah. Fabulous.
I mean, that way of genre organizing.
I want to go to that store. Anne and Emily, is Joe the most Christie we've had on?
I feel
that's like such a Christy Thomas description. Ambitious women whose stories haven't been told, because she has that whole, you know, service orientation too.
Yes.
That I feel like is so central to her character.
Oh my God. I'm so honored that I'm the most Christy.
We've had a lot of Christies on.
Yes, it is funny. Most people who want. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Everyone who writes us emails is Marianne. Everyone who wants to come on the show is Christy.
Yeah. That tracks, guys. That really tracks.
Yeah. It really does. And we love it.
So I was first introduced to you, Joe, through We Are Not Like Them, which I really, really enjoyed. And I got real Mal and Jesse vibes while reading it. And I was like, texted Anne about it back when it first came out of like, you should read this. It's like a sophisticated adult version of Mal and Jesse going back and forth. So I'm just curious about if you thought about that at all in the back of your mind while you and Christine Pride were writing it and what that process was like.
I did. And you know, the Mal and Jesse friendship, I think, was so ahead of its time. And Christine and I say a lot. So We Are Not Like Them is a book about two best friends. One is white, one is black. And it does center on a police shooting and what happens to their friendship as they have to reckon with race for the first time. And Christine is a black woman. She used to be my book editor, and now she is my co-writer, which means I lost my editor, which was so sad. But you know, I gained a co-writer. And we were friends, and as someone who's worked in books for so long, Christine would always say, I never see really, you know, complicated and also authentic interracial friendships on the page. And I said, but what about Jesse and Mal? And it's true. We don't, and, you know, we trotted out this statistic a lot when we were on book tour for We Are Not Like Them, that something like close to 90% of people don't have a close friend of another race.
Yeah.
And
really high.
Wow.
And we don't see it. We barely see it in books. And when we see it in movies, it feels very forced.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the sassy black friend or the like nervous white friend in the black movie.
100% every time. Or like the reboot of Sex and the City where you're like, what just happened? But I think, you know, Mal and Jesse's friendship felt so organic, authentic, and just easy. And it was. But the fact that that was the only example I could think of in books. I was like, but what about the Babysitter's Club? Shows that there is a lack of this in commercial literature.
Yeah.
That's so cool. I'm glad that inspired the book. And it's cool to like look back at your childhood influences and they just kind of naturally influence what you do today, like without even thinking about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we want to talk about your new book.
Oh, I always want to talk about the new book.
Yes,
right? I know. I'm freak about it.
So it's called, again, Sicilian Inheritance, and it comes out April 2nd.
Yes.
So let's talk about how you decided to write this book. I know that it was inspired by your own great-great-grandmother. So give us a little bit of background about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Sicilian Inheritance, I genuinely think, and my agent backed this up, and she doesn't bullshit me anymore, that it is the best book that I've ever written, okay? It's a novel, and it is loosely based on the murder of my great-great-grandmother, Lorenza Marsala, in Sicily a century ago. My family has been telling this story for as long as I can remember, but no one really knows what is true about it because we're Italian-American, so we're a bunch of liars and storytellers. And so every family member has a different version of this story. And what we know is that she was left by her husband so he could come make a better life in America. Her husband came here. Her sons came over here. She was there for quite some time, and then she was murdered. And then every family member has a different version of what happened. Was it the mob? Was she murdered for being a witch? Like, I mean, all of these theories are out there. You know, we had no idea. I wanted to focus on what would it be like to be a woman left alone in Sicily during this time period. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A lot of men did leave. So this is a time when women started taking on the men's jobs. They were handling the money for the first time. They were learning to read for the first time. They were really taking on responsibility. And I think it could have been awesome, too, because they didn't have to be a wife or get pregnant every 9 months.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then I wanted to have a modern woman from Philadelphia today go back to Sicily and try to claim her family's land and solve this murder. But she gets caught up in the same forces that originally tried to take her great-grandmother down. So it is an adventure. It is it is a murder mystery, but it is also a frothy adventure through Sicily filled with food and wine and not gratuitous sex, but very attractive people wearing wonderful outfits. And it's just a lot of fun. I've been, you know, I read a lot for work and there's some incredible books being published right now, but so many of them are so dark and leave me feeling just unhappy. And I wanted more joy in my life. So I decided to write a book where you also you don't feel dumber for having read it, which there's a lot of those out right now as well, but where you're going to feel smart, you're going to feel like, you know, satisfied, but you're also just going to have fun. Like the Sicilian Inheritance is a book you can pick up and read on a plane and you'll be like, I feel great after having read that. Whereas a lot of the big books that I've read right now, I'm like, I feel like crap. Yeah. I feel bad about the world. Or I'll read, you know, and I'm not like, you know, denigrating, you know, any book genre as fluff, but I read some and I'm like, I am fucking dumber for reading that. So I wanted to find that sweet spot. And I think the Sicilian Inheritance is it. But back to the mystery of it all, I wrote the book. I didn't want to dive into the true story because I wanted to write fiction. Mm-hmm. But once it was over, I was like, oh, I can't stop myself. I need to solve this murder.
So Christy.
So I told you, I'm just a classic Christy. So I did. So I took my children, my three children under the age of 6, and took them to Sicily last summer.
Ooh. Wow. Yeah.
And started recording a true crime podcast called The Sicilian Inheritance. It's dropping shortly. We'll have the trailer up very soon. Where I solve her murder, where I solve Lorenza's actual murder.
And
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's been a ride. It's not solved. It's not solved yet, but I'm going back to Sicily in 10 days and I'm intent on solving it while I'm there. But we've got some freaking bombshells in there, man. Like the things I've discovered are about a century old murder are insane. It's White Lotus meets Only Murders in the Building.
That's say no more.
Yeah.
Right? Yes.
You've got us and all of our listeners. Yeah.
I know. Yeah. I know. So yeah. So that's, I've just been solving a mystery for the past year, bumbling around the Sicilian countryside, much like the BSC bumbled around the mall.
Exactly.
Wow.
That's a beautiful
chef's
segue.
Kiss segue.
Yeah. I like that you did the segue for us.
I know. She's a pro, good. You guys.
She is a pro. Yeah. So what did you think about Stacy's own mystery at the mall? Was it a mystery?
So I really, can we spoil the mystery?
Because yes.
Yes. Okay.
It is time.
It is time. All right. All the members of the BSC get jobs at the mall. Because then this is part of the public schools in Stony Brook, Connecticut are like really nice.
Amazing. Yeah.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. They have this class that changes like every quarter where they learn practical life skills. And like, what school does that now?
Yeah. Wait, I forgot what the name of the class is.
Well, this segment
like life
was
life skills.
Yeah,
it?
It's life it's skills. Like, but life this segment skills. Was project work.
Project
but
work.
This is what's project the work. But what's the what do they call the classes?
Oh, wasn't it like short? Short takes or something.
Oh
like,
yeah,
something
short
like that, right?
Yeah.
I was like, it's like a hot take.
Hot take. It's like a quickie. Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly. And so this version of the class is that they all have to get jobs, and all of the BSC members get jobs at the mall. And it's just so cute. They all take a bus there after school, and they can't babysit while they're doing it because they have these jobs at the mall. And Stacy is working at the toy store. And Christy's working in security, by the way. That seemed a little like it seemed
hysterical.
Like
I can't.
It seemed like Christy was being given a little bit too much power for a 13-year-old. Okay,
That took Anne out completely.
Yeah.
That's like what?
Yeah, yep. But I also like the head of security at the mall was a woman, which I think was Anne Martin's way of just switching gender roles generally, right?
Sure.
Because. You think about the head of security, and then I remember it being like, oh, Mrs. And I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
So they get to the mall. All of them very quickly realize that things are being stolen from the mall. And the other clue is it seems like someone might be living in the mall. And that was the moment that I'm like, oh, God, it's going to be homeless kids. It's going to be homeless kids.
I just know
it's going to be homeless kids. How is the BSC going to deal with this?
Yeah.
But it's. Even there's two plot twists, right? There's two mysteries that they have to solve because there's petty crime and then there's grand theft happening at the mall. And so it's homeless kids, but then it's also the mall manager who's essentially stealing large items because he can't balance the books. This is
because
he just keeps giving things away.
Thief with a heart of gold.
He's a thief. He's Robin Hood is what he is. Yeah. He's stealing TVs. To throw community events at the mall.
Yes.
And so the girl, the club, I don't want to say the girls because Logan's involved. The club.
Yes. Good.
I want to be inclusive. They are solving these dual mysteries of what is happening at the mall. Now, the level of danger that they make it seem that they are in is very intense. Like Stacy is just constantly worried that not only is there going to be like petty thievery, but like someone's going to hold her up at gunpoint and kill her. She's just like, I just felt unsafe. I just like felt really unsafe being there. And I'm like, you grew up in New York City, bitch.
Yeah.
Like you're really afraid of whoever is stealing this video game from the toy store in the suburban Connecticut mall.
That's true. It's true. Dawn would have been freaked out.
Implausible. Yeah. Dawn would have been a little bitch for sure.
For sure. Yeah.
It just didn't feel very Stacy of me, of her. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah.
So they set out to solve this mystery. I do think it was pretty clear from the beginning. I didn't want it to be the homeless kids, okay? Yeah. Because I was like, oh my God, how did these kids end up homeless? What's gonna happen when CPS inevitably gets involved? Mm-hmm. Is the BSC up to this challenge of dealing with a very bureaucratic system? And the answer is they weren't.
It was all ill-prepared.
Very ill-prepared, all handled very badly in the end. And they really hoodwinked those poor children is what they did. They really tricked them.
Okay, we forgot about the like faint, right? So at first the mystery is solved because like a big group of teenagers gets arrested.
Oh yeah.
And they're like, these are the thieves, but like they were not the thieves after, because they weren't doing the big crime or the petty crime,
or the petty
stealing
crime.
Supplies.
They were just being teenagers.
Yeah.
That was back to my life's work of not blaming teenagers for fucking everything.
Yeah. They were the only innocents.
Yeah.
Only innocents. Exactly. Exactly. But you also knew that it wasn't over then. You're like, it's not them. It's not them, guys. Come on. Come on.
Yeah.
That was the quote unquote sting operation that Christy was talking about.
Yeah. She had the inside scoop because she really works for security.
They told her too much is what they did.
They did.
Yeah. Why did they give a 13-year-old a walkie-talkie? I don't understand.
Right? Like, what exactly was she supposed to be? Like, if you were an intern in the security office as a child, you'd think they'd be like, why don't you make some copies? And they're like,
yeah,
Christy, go patrol the mall. Here's your walkie-talkie.
Yeah. Go pop in on your friends and see what's up. Yeah.
I will say the image of Christy I had was like Paul Blart Mall Cop.
Mall Cop. Yeah.
which made it extra funny.
Well, and I also... Yeah, the thing that really took me out was when Stacy runs into the guy in the ski mask in the storage space behind Toy Town.
Yeah.
And then Christy comes to like assess the scene.
Yeah.
And she says, we'll get him. I promise you we will. Like,
so intense.
That's
what got me too. I'm like, I'm like, where are the adults in this situation?
Yeah.
Where are the adults? Also, so like the other such 80s thing is that all of the parents are bringing their children to the mall to work with them. And I was talking about this the other day with someone. My mom was a teacher. She was a special ed teacher. And when I was sick, she would just take me to school with her.
Mm-hmm.
So she didn't take off work. I would go sit in the teacher's lounge.
We sit in an office in a corner.
I would sit in the corner, and like I would like lay under the blanket and like read the Babysitter's Club books.
Yeah.
And that was fine. That was totally acceptable. And it looks like everyone at the mall is just bringing their kids to work and like making them sit in the corner.
Yeah.
Well, there's a hole for the Babysitter's Club service that they provide.
That's the thing. There was, it wasn't just the dual mysteries. It was also that Christy created a new business of the daycare center at the mall. She saw this like one sad lone child and was like, ding, ding, ding. We're going to create a babysitting service in the mall, which, by the way, they did ignore the fact that it's not as easy as just renovating the old arcade and getting a babysitter in there. Yeah. There's a lot of liability and insurance issues with putting a daycare facility in a mall.
For sure. They mentioned they did some hand waving about paperwork at one point.
They did.
Someone said they had to get file the right licenses.
Yes.
But it was,
But also, it's Stacy's idea first, and then Christy's a little sour about it. And then the next day, Christy comes in and is like, all right, let's get it done. Because
it's my idea. It's my idea. Christy tricked even me, right? Because I didn't even remember that. I was like, it was all Christy all the time.
Oh, good.
Oh, my God. Anything else that jumped out to you, Joe, or parts of the book that you especially liked or things that were surprising to you?
You know, I did find it really surprising, like the way they brought in the mall manager. Again, it was a kind of a class thing. Like they talked a lot about how he wanted to cater to the community. He was doing like a lot of outreach with, I think they even said with like a homeless shelter with poor people. Like they use words like rich and poor very often. And I did like that they made him a little more nuanced than expected. But then he did become a villain very quickly because they're like, oh, he's a good guy. But then they're like, he's bullying these poor homeless children.
Yeah, threatening them.
He's threatening these homeless children. And also the way they became homeless was
super sketchy about that.
Yeah.
Pretty sketch. Like their mom was sick and had to go to the hospital and they didn't want to bother her. So they moved into the mall. It was all a little bit Basil-y Frankweiler-y, and also made me so nostalgic for the mall though. I don't know how much time all of you spent in the mall growing up.
Yeah.
So much time. So much time. I mean, as a young child, like, you know, but then also as a teenager, it was just all mall all the time. My first boyfriend worked at the Chick-fil-A in the food court.
Nice.
You know, he always smelled like chicken, which was weirdly comforting. I have a weird kink for guys who can now make me fried chicken. And but it was, the mall was just like the epicenter of our lives. And I'm so curious about what kids, like where kids hang now, because malls are no longer, yeah. I mean, malls are sad, sad places. Yeah. I went
A lot of them don't. Is the like
what do they do friend. Where do they go, so what is I have a
13-year-old and a 15-year-old, and my 15-year-old is really bummed about the lack of third spaces, you know, like there's just not, like we're watching Friends now for the first time and my 15-year-old is obsessed with it because they spend so much time in the coffee shop, like they're like, there's a place to go and hang out with your people, and like it does not seem to be as much of a thing.
That is such a, well, it's not as enough of a thing for grownups either. And I think about that all the time with my fictitious bookstore that I want to open.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, I would love a third space. Or it's like, oh, if I walk in here, I'm probably going to run into someone else I know from the neighborhood.
Totally. Like, Emily has one. That's why she's smiling smugly.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But it's interesting. So my coffee shop, The West, Brooklyn, is a coffee shop and a bar. And the same 10 people have worked there for 15 years.
Yeah.
And everyone in the neighborhood is, who's a regular, all knows each other. It's very, like, very friends-like. But because it's a bar, like, teenagers don't really hang out there. So, like, right. 7 years ago, a Starbucks opened, like, a block down, and it's always busy, even though there's, like, a good local coffee shop on the same block, because it's mostly filled with teenagers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And, like, totally. You know, people who live in the building above it, like doing work on their laptops, but like people with small kids, people with are just teens on their own. It like really filled a kind of gap in third spaces for teenagers in the neighborhood, because everything else is a bar.
That is really nice. And also, I mean, I just think cities need to be reimagined. We have so much dead retail space here in Philly. I know, you know, a lot of cities do. It should all be imagined into some kind of third space. So you can have you can make it capitalist. You can sell stuff, but like find a place, especially close to, my kids go to the public school down the street, and there's all these just like sad empty businesses right across the street from the school. I'm like, make it a coffee shop. The parents would go there every day after drop off.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, nice things.
Nice things. I know, but guys, can I tell you like the most egotistical shitty thing about me? I'm like, all right.
Yes, please.
I will. I'm like, well, I need the Sicilian. Like, I've had successful books and stuff, but like, I love the Sicilian inheritance the most. So I'm like, well, I need it to like do good things in the world. Otherwise, I think I'll be depressed being surrounded by books all the time. I might come out of it, but like, I'm like, oh no. I'm like, it would definitely help. Like, I think I would be more of like, more excited about the whole thing. Like, if this does well come April, but you never know, because book launches, I will say, because I loved the Babysitter's Club so much, and she was such a prolific writer, that it's one of the things that inspired me to write books, and being an author seemed like such a fancy, wonderful thing. Mm-hmm. And I think in the 80s it was.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Anna Martin had it good. Yeah.
She had it good, right?
Yeah.
I have a friend who saw her recently at a bookstore in Western Massachusetts, and she seems like she's living a nice life. What? Yeah.
I'm sorry, Emily.
Have you had her on?
No,
she's like notoriously introverted. Yeah. Like, I mean, she really wanted to.
Well, she did so well in the 80s that she disappeared.
That's how well she did. It was, we had the producers of the Netflix show on, and they talked about meeting her to pitch the show, and how they got like one meeting with her, like upstate New York, with at a cafe one time, and how, you know, she's just like very shy. She's a Marianne. She's like deeply a Marianne, so she doesn't do a lot of press. Mm-hmm. She doesn't, you know, that's our goal someday, but we haven't tried very hard yet. Mm-hmm. Because
if I had Ann M. Martin money, I would be a Marianne too, and I'd go live
there. Exactly.
What must be nice. I'm here for that. But I'm a Christie, and I have to hustle.
Yeah. Oh, all right, yeah. Emily. What political feminist things that we haven't talked about already jumped out to you?
I'm not going to do a whole deep dive on CPS because it's really, really depressing. But I just will. I will say, like, the history of child welfare in the U.S. is really bleak. It like has its origins in eugenics, that we can cure social and political ills by fixing them either before birth, right, with sort of like forced sterilization and like actual kind of eugenic stuff, or by like removing children from their families where problematic traits will be passed on, and kind of placing them with better families. So it, you know, the term child welfare is a bit of a misnomer in terms of the history of the actual institutions and practices. And you know, in continuing into the present moment, it has still functions as a tool of social control. Yeah. There's this woman who's this incredible legal scholar, Dorothy Roberts. I've talked about her a lot on the podcast. But she, her new book actually is about child welfare, and she makes a case for abolition of foster care, essentially, but like all the kind of related things. And she has this stat that she keeps pulling out on her book tour that is just astounding. So like 53% of Black children in the United States experience a CPS investigation at some point during their childhood. 53%. Mm-hmm. Isn't that wild? And like the overwhelming evidence suggests that most people who are in the foster care system have families that want them, but like for whatever reason, because of bureaucratic bullshit, like can't get them and make a claim on them. So the whole thing is just sad, sad, sad. And like, you know, Joe, you pointed out at the beginning that like the babysitters don't handle it very well, right? Like Stacey calls the cops and they call a social worker and they're like, oh, it's going to work out fine for them. But that's probably not historically accurate, right? Mm-hmm. Like if that were really to happen in the 80s, and particularly if they were children of color, like the outcomes from that phone call are not going to be good outcomes. And Stacey would in all likelihood, like later, regret having done that. Or I don't know. I mean, what's the option?
I guess, but this is in my section too, but rather than having to talk about CPS twice, I thought that that was one of the smart things about the book. So first of all, it started in the 80s, but this we're in 1994 now. Mm-hmm. And they're very clear that it's three blonde children, right? So these are three white kids.
So very clear, without saying, hey, look at these white children.
Yeah. And as you
pointed
out,
white kids can be poor too.
Yeah. As you pointed out, the way they became homeless is very clean, right? Mm-hmm. Like there are no villains in the story. Like someone dies, mom goes to the hospital, like, and Mara, the older sister, like steps up to try to take care of her younger kids. Mm-hmm. So I have to say of the younger kids in this situation, I think it actually would work out okay, because you've got three blonde children. And then they say like, oh, and mom's getting better and she's ready to come home and they're going to get these services to help them be together. And I think that that was a smart way of doing it. Because I'm not saying that it's good that it would work out okay because it's three suburban children in Connecticut, but they also haven't ended up being homeless because they were being directly abused or something terrible. You know, it was like poverty and misfortune, not
most
someone
kids
not caring about
aren't
them.
What we call abuse isn't what we or most like neglect, right? Isn't actually abuse.
Neglect is a really problematic thing. And I will say, you know, what I was going to talk about in my kid as someone who spends probably a lot more time talking to children and teens that have been abused than like abused, not neglected, than you do, Emily. There was need, and part of the goal of, you know, we didn't have any child abuse reporting regularity until 1974. Mm-hmm. And the goal of that was to correct some of these origins of child welfare that you're talking about, and also to make sure that people did report white families. Because what was happening when there was no federal law, and it's not a perfect system. There are a lot of problems with CPS, and there are a lot of people who are really trying to help kids stay safe in there as well. It's a big dialectic. But what was happening before 1974 is that it was like, oh, well, that man is a dentist and serves on city council. He couldn't possibly abuse his children. And so no one that had contact with that kid who was getting the shit beat out of him would do anything about it. And that's why we have mandated reporting laws. And so that's why, you know, me as a psychologist, your mom as a teacher, Joe, and, you know, Emily's mom and my mom as teachers, and, you know, and Anne's mom, actually, wow, we got a lot of teacher moms on this episode, you know, have to make those calls. So like the system is not good, and there are a lot of problems with it. And there are a lot of broad definitions of especially neglect, as you mentioned, Emily.
Yeah.
And I am really interested in abolition and in finding, similar to what we've talked about with like mental health and the police, right? Finding ways for people to get help to those kids. And we've seen a change, especially in the last 20 years, toward preserving family unification that is going a long way, but there's still a lot of people that shouldn't have contact with CPS that do.
Right.
So, but I thought it was smart to make them white kids for the purposes of the story.
Yeah, I just think, you know, in the long tradition of things that we've talked about in the BSC universe that have shocking racist origins, CPS is another one. That was just
Got
something
a lot of them
to,
on the
to
list.
Flag.
Yeah.
It's really interesting to me that CPS came up in this book, because it feels like this book was meant for me. You guys chose it essentially, but it really felt like it was supposed to be my episode, because my book that I just wrote before Sicilian Inheritance, You Were Always Mine, is about CPS. It's about a Black woman who finds an abandoned white baby, and she doesn't want to call the police because, as a Black woman and a former foster child, she has dealt with the system and she knows exactly what happens when she does call the police, and that's not the best situation. But that's not the interesting part here. The interesting part is in that this book got like really torn up in a lot of reader reviews on various reader sites that I won't name. And people are like, she's a monster for not calling the police.
Oh.
And these are all, I mean, it's mostly white women saying this.
Yeah.
And it just, such, the comments on this book ended up being so racial, and much more racial than our book that we actually wrote about race. People just, like, a lot of people really did not like this Black woman having this white baby.
Yeah. Wow. Well, the official Stuck in Stony Brook position is anti the carceral state. So we're with you.
The official Stuck in Stony Brook. Yeah. Okay, I just had two other little nuggets. Stacy, when she's building the dollhouse in the toy store, so she's learning a lot about how to move product. And one thing you do to move product is to change up the window displays. I loved her little narration on
teaching
that.
Teaching us that, yeah.
Yeah, and then she puts the mom doll in the garage and like the dad doll in the kitchen or whatever, and says this is a liberated doll family, which I thought was very funny.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that.
Yeah. And she's like trying to teach the little kid, right? Like she's playing with the April, the store owner's son, because she doesn't have childcare, right? Enough days of the week. And that's in part what motivates the creation of the daycare center. And then there was just one other little thing. At some point when they're trying to suss out the mystery, Christy says, "Smells like a rat," as Watson would say. And I was like, what? What's with, like, why did she go to the trouble of flagging that that's like a Watson quote in particular? Isn't that weird?
I had also forgotten that his name was Watson.
Yeah, yeah. It's such a good, like, rich guy name. Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, now that it's back in my life, if we get a pet in this house, like a hamster, I'm going to put Watson forward for the
name. That's a perfect name for a hamster. Yeah. It might also amuse you that in our canon of the extended Babysitter's Club universe, we have decided that Watson is the either like heir or sort of CEO founder of Sunbeam Toasters. So toaster ovens money. In particular.
Because in one book it mentioned him like using like three toasters to make breakfast. And we're like, why do you have
for all
toasters?
The kids. Yeah.
Okay. That was logical conclusion.
Yeah.
Do we think Watson's hot? Because I also reading I think Watson's pretty hot. And I think that Christy's mom might be a smoke show too.
Yeah.
Reading it now, I'm realizing that the parents are probably my age.
Oh yeah. They're younger, Joe. They're younger than us.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. That's a weird thing to think about.
Yeah. It's very weird.
Yeah.
It's very weird.
Esme, did you have other things?
I just, you know, I thought it was hilarious that the 11-year-olds have these jobs through Project Work too. I thought that was a stretch.
Jesse's job seems especially demanding.
Yeah, yeah. Jesse's working hard in the movie theater
I think that they're working Jesse way too hard. But also Jesse and Mal are in a different grade. Why are they why are they also doing Project
The
Work?
Whole school's doing it at the same time. I don't understand. Is it a 3-year cycle? Yeah. It's very confusing.
Yeah, when you think about an 11-year-old, they look very young.
Yeah, no, that's not.
And seeing like 11-year-old in little like movie theater uniform, like
sweeping the floor. Yeah, no.
Yeah, borderline problematic.
Yeah.
Borderline problematic, yes. Well, speaking of Jessie, she's working at Cinema World. Mm-hmm. That's her job, which it seems like a pretty cool job, except she does mention on a page about a movie she had to see 10 times. Mm-hmm. And she was like, oh, it wasn't very good. Right. Mm-hmm. So I was trying to think what movie it could be in April 94. Mm-hmm. So I did a quick rundown of what was out in April 94 in the movie theaters. Mm-hmm. And also then kind of edited out like any movies Jesse wouldn't be able to see.
That right. It's not R-rated.
Yeah, I tried to keep it to things that she would be interested in as an 11-year-old.
Don't tell mom the babysitter's dead.
That's see, that would be a good movie though.
Yeah.
She wouldn't say that was bad.
Yeah, right. I don't know.
So there's there's a lot of sequels out. White Fang 2. I feel like anything with an animal she would like. White Fang 2.
Yeah.
Monkey Trouble was out. Beethoven Second was out. Oh. So these are all movies she would really like, I feel.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then the movie that I saw that I think she would see 10 times that was not good is the movie Clifford.
Oh, no.
Starring Martin Short, where Martin Short plays a little boy.
Oh, God.
Oh, no, yeah. No.
Yeah, it's true. But it's just funny because I recently rewatched that movie.
Rewatched it recently. Interesting. Yes,
like last month. Because my husband.
10 times in 1 month.
Yeah, 10 times in 1 month. And it's not good.
Yeah, no.
But it's not good. I watched a YouTube interview with Martin Short about that movie. What was interesting is that before Clifford came out, the movie Problem Child came out. Remember that movie?
Oh, uh-huh. I do.
So the producers were like, I don't know, we can't have another movie about the same idea with like this kind of annoying kid. So what they did instead, they replaced a child actor with Martin Short.
Oh, no.
No.
And that's how they made it different.
Sometimes I think civilization has gone backwards, but moments like that make me think it's a little bit better 30 years later.
Yeah, no, totally.
No, it's not. Don't second guess yourself, friend. Don't.
Right. But another fun thing I thought we could talk about is what store we would want to work at the mall.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Natural Wonders.
Oh, that was going to be mine. Or the Nature Store.
Yeah, Nature the Company.
Nature Company, yeah. We've talked about this a lot on the podcast before.
So In this world, I'm 13, right? Mm-hmm. Hot Topic, baby. Hot Topic.
Yeah. Nice.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like I would like it's either Claire's or the bookstore.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Were you that into accessories?
No, but well, I was really into earrings.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. I do have like 13 holes in my ears still.
Do you? Wow.
That's the most impressed Joe's been on the podcast. Yeah.
I have 10 in my ears and 1 in my face.
Well, yeah. I've got
10.
I have 7 left. But the thing is, I just once I take earrings out, I just never put them back in. I'm so bad at putting them back in.
Oh, yeah, I just never take them out.
Wait, so do you have 5 in each ear?
Emily?
Emily.
I have 6 in one and 4 in the other.
Oh, you're such an individual.
Such an individual.
Yeah, that's really Stacey. Stacey-esque.
Claire's.
Yes. Claire's, yeah. You'd be like getting the free earrings or getting that discount. So that was kind of what I want to talk about, just the mall stuff. But also, there was a lot of good food. A lot of good junk food. Let's see. I wrote it down here.
There was Orange Julius, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That's just quintessential mall.
Oh, such a treat.
There's some pretzels, of course.
Yeah.
Stacey. Mm-hmm. Oh, remember Hershey Minis. I feel like they haven't brought up Hershey Minis before. Mm-mm.
Yeah. And why does Chrissy like Special Dark? I feel like that's an old man flavor.
That is an old man flavor. Like,
you know, like rereading it. And I remember this was striking to me as a kid. I didn't have any friends with diabetes. It seemed like something very exotic and different at the time. But like they really hammer diabetes.
Hard.
It is just like every mention of food, Stacey's like, but there was a special food because I can't eat that.
Yeah.
It's really
and it's always pretzels or crackers.
I know.
Actually, well, in this book, I think she got some cookies with sweetened with fruit juice, actually.
Yes.
Which sounds
so gross.
Yeah.
Sound good.
When she goes to the donut shop, she has a bagel.
Mm-hmm.
She does. Yeah. She does, which feels like it would maybe spike her insulin.
Yeah, bagel does not seem low. Yeah.
No.
Less direct sugars. But
All those carbs turn into sugar.
Yeah.
Cheeto paws.
Oh, I forgot about those. Yeah.
Cheeto paws. They've never meant Chrissy got an M&M cookie at the mall, which is obviously Mrs. Fields.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's some Ring Dings, Three Musketeers. Yeah, there was some, you know, Orange Julius, some good food in here.
Lots of food. Yeah.
Good.
Excellent.
Oh, and burritos, of course.
Yes. Yeah.
Wait, what is it that Logan learns how to make that he's all excited about? The chef like teaches him how to make
enchiladas.
Yeah. Also, LOL at the fact that everyone is like kind of sussing out their career aspirations by working at places that align to their interests. And then Logan works at Casa Grande.
But then he thinks he might want to be a chef. He's like into it.
Yeah,
that's true.
So funny.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This is how you learn things about yourself, Anne. That's why Work is such a special program.
It really is a special program.
Picturing him in the kitchen, like nowadays anyway, the people in the kitchen are most likely to be speaking Spanish, regardless of what kind of kitchen and whether or not it's a Casa Grande.
Yeah.
And he's like this young teenager with a Southern drawl. Like, what's he talking about with the guys in the kitchen?
Yeah. Fabulous. Not a lot of tallies in this book. So, Joe, we track the like stereotypes they say about each other and their descriptors at the beginning. But we do have the return, unfortunately, of both almond shaped eyes and exotic for Claudia, which has been gone for like 8 books.
Wow.
So I was sort of optimistic that they were starting to phase it out in the mid 90s, but it is back. And one shy, one sensitive, and one individual for Dawn, even though she's out here on the left coast. They had to mention that she's an individual.
I do remember almond-shaped eyes, like very, very well. I do. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
My eyes almond-shaped.
And likes to do a bit where she tries to figure out what kind of nut our eyes are shaped like.
Oh, what kind of nut are my are my eyes shaped like?
Oh, you have pretty big eyes.
Yeah. Well, I've got fake eyelashes on because I was just recording 2020. And so my babysitter helped me put fake eyelashes on.
Oh my God. Amazing.
Feel like a, maybe like
so
a,
appropriate for a BSC podcast recording to follow.
Yeah.
Feel like a Brazil nut is pretty big, right?
Well, I'm Brazil nutty.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Oh my God. Okay. What were our favorite lines from the book? There weren't a lot of good one-liners in this one.
No.
Mine. Yeah. I didn't underline a whole lot.
Yeah.
I put baby tell me a story because I just thought it was funny.
Yeah.
Such a weird name. Yeah. I mean, Liberated Doll Family is up there for me, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, I like Liberated Doll Family. Yeah.
Yeah. I also just like We'll Get Him was a good one.
We'll Get Him.
This guy was Liberated Doll Family.
Doll Family. I think I would make that the name of my like mom jam band.
I was going to say a ska band.
Right.
Full of ideas. Like ideas.
Maybe Nice Things can have like a venue there too.
Where Liberated Doll Family can play.
Just waiting for the Nice Things merch. Like, I want that tote bag. No. I want a hoodie.
Yeah.
Guys, do you want to know my mad marketing plan for Nice Things?
Oh, yeah.
There'll be a mural on the side of the building, much like Books Are Magic, where, by the way, Sicilian Inheritance is launching at Books Are Magic for those of you in Brooklyn.
Exciting.
Oh, Emily, you should go.
No, you should definitely come. But so there's a mural that says Nice Things, but we'll give you signs to hold in front of it that says, I deserve nice things, or he should get me nice things, or I broke my nice things.
Nice.
I love that. That's very grammable.
Nice excellent.
I know. Always be selling. Always be selling, my friends.
Okay, well, Joe, thank you so much for coming on our podcast. So again, Sicilian Inheritance out April 2nd. Everyone go get it. Everyone go buy it.
Now. Yeah, it is my favorite. I have a lot of really nice blurbs, but my favorite is from Jane Green, who's an author that I love. She's like, it's just the perfect travel book. And I'm like, great. Yes.
Amazing. We'll have it linked on our bookshop too, everybody. So with all of Joe's books that are available on bookshop, we'll put them up there.
And is there anything else you'd like to mention? Your podcast, where people can find you?
Yeah. You know, I have the podcast Under the Influence, which started out being a podcast about social media and still is, but it's also kind of widened to what it means to be a woman in the world. And you can find me on the Instagrams, which I hate, but I'm on them anyway, at Joe Piazza Author.
Yeah, sounds familiar. That's sort of how we feel about it, too.
Just hate it, but you know, not gonna stop because gotta sell books. So
gotta be Christy.
Gotta be Christy.
So Joe, we like to close every episode with a pizza toast, like the girls raising their pizza and toasting to their friendship. So we like to propose something from the book to toast to. It can be saccharine and earnest, or it can be ridiculous and tangentially related. Do you have any thoughts on what we should toast to from this book?
I'm going to go a little saccharine. I want to toast to the future of these children who are living in the mall. And it's a hopeful toast that things look up for them.
Despite
what happened with the BSC.
A pizza toast to the homeless kids at the mall and their future.
The future.
Right.
Yeah.
Homeless Kids Future.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Joe. This has been amazing. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you.
This episode of Stuck in Stony Brook is now adjourned.
Thank you to Anna and Martin for everything. Stuck in Stony Brook is edited by Emily Crandall. Theme song written and recorded by Gary Schaller, performed by the band Kid Kit. You can follow us on Instagram at Stuck in Stony Brook or find us on our website, stuckinstonybrook.com. Need some books that we mentioned? Buy them from our bookshop and support both a local independent bookstore and your favorite series literature analysis podcast. Find us at bookshop.org/shop/stuckinstonybrook. Lastly, if you're feeling doubly generous and you want to rate us and review us on Apple Podcasts, that would be super helpful. You're the best friends a girl could ask for.